Good afternoon, everyone. How are you today? Oh, so I was in this room on Monday, and those lights were about four times brighter. I couldn't see any of you. I'm much happier now. This is great. Is everybody enjoying Tech Ed so far? Yes. Yeah, seeing a lot of good stuff? Good. Hopefully some great sessions, learning a lot of wonderful things. So here we are on day three. If you may have been to some of the talks I've already been giving about some of the unit testing stuff, but to be completely honest with you, all week I've been mostly excited about coming and giving this talk. I really wanted to come and show you guys some of the wild and crazy things that we can do with the fakes features in Visual Studio 2012. My name is Peter Provost. I'm a program manager lead in the Visual Studio Ultimate team. And for the last couple years, I have been focusing... Don't get too close. For the last couple years, I've been focusing on delivering tools for agile developers, paying particular attention to the unit testing world, working on changes that we made to the Unit Test Explorer, to enabling third-party frameworks in Visual Studio, trying to make everything fast, and easy to use. But we're often running into this interesting problem when we're writing unit tests and when we're developing in that we have dependencies. We have things we have to deal with. Now, before I get too far into this, just a quick warning. I'm going to be writing some ugly code. It's kind of the point of the talk. So if you don't want to see ugly code, and if you're looking for kind of an overview of fakes, you'll probably get that in about the first half. In the second half, I'm going to be digging in some ugly stuff. And hopefully, I would love it if you guys were all willing to ask questions. We don't need to wait until the end to ask questions. If you put your hand up and yell, or put your hand up, I'll point. You yell out the question, I'll repeat it so the recording people get it, and we'll try to get that answered. Of course, too much of that, and we won't get to the really cool stuff, which I've saved for the end, so we kind of have to find a good balance here. Fair? So, you know, there's a lot of things that contribute to the quality of our systems that we build. We know that code reviews are a huge component, but one of the other things that is a massive contributor to the quality of the systems we build is automated testing, and in particular, automated unit testing written by developers. You know, I'm sure you've heard it a few dozen times, you know, the best time to find a bug is before you write it or immediately after you write it. And the best time to express what you expect a function to do is right as you're writing it. The problem is legacy code. And when I say legacy code, I mean the phrase or the term in the same way that Michael Feathers does in his book, Working Effectively with Legacy Code, which is code that you didn't just write that doesn't have unit tests. Okay? So when we have these legacy code systems, it's hard. I'm not gonna lie to you, it is. And for years now, people have come up to me and said, I have this system, it's got 250,000 lines of code, I don't know what to do, help! And I pick up my copy of Working Effectively with Legacy Code and I say, go read this. And then come back and talk to me. So I would recommend, of course, that you read that book. That book is a marvelous resource. Michael Feathers is kind of the god in the space. But even if you follow all the stuff he says in the book, it's still hard. And there's a lot of gotchas and a lot of issues. And most of them have to do with dependencies, dependencies that our classes and methods have outside of themselves. That's where things get really ugly, things that are tightly coupled. So, you know, my statement here is that it's hard and sometimes impossible. Or is it? Untestable code comes in a whole lot of varieties. Okay? We can find it in a lot of places. I've been hearing people say it's get or done code. Right? Your deadline's coming, your boss is looming, your sprint is ending. You got commitments coming at you, you gotta get or done. Right? So what do? You do whatever you gotta do to get it done. I've also heard this kind of a more, prosaic term, coding by expediency, the big ball of mud pattern, all these other kinds of things that we like to talk about. Right, so what do? We put our business logic and our code behind file. We couple things together. We new up everything that we ever need right where we need it. Sometimes this is good, sometimes this is bad. We have classes that are way too big, way too many dependencies, methods that are gigantic and do hundreds of things. This makes it really hard to test. database logic mixed in. Years ago, I was working with a team helping them deal with some of these kinds of issues. It was right after I came to Microsoft. And before coming to Microsoft, I was in consulting, training and consulting people on agile practices and software development, all that good stuff. And I mentioned the idea of testability and designing for test. And the guy actually said to me, "Oh no, I don't believe in that. Nope, not gonna design for test." I said, "But what if it was the case that designing for test meant you were actually doing better design?" "Oh, I don't believe that." I thought that was kind of interesting. Later on, I turned him around. There's a bunch of common indicators that we can use to identify code that is going to be hard to test, things that are going to catch us when we get there. If, when writing a test for something, it has extremely complex setup and teardown, that's an indication that the system was designed poorly. So we know that one. We've already found that by the fact that while we were testing it, we had to do 37 lines of setup, or setup that took 60 seconds to run. So we've already clearly learned that one was hard to test. Environmental dependencies are notorious for being hard to test. Code that depends on datetime.now, code that depends on environment.getwellknown folder or whatever it might be in order to find a particular user directory. When you run that test on the build server, whose folder does it find? I'm not sure. It might not find anybody, because it might not be that we have even a desktop. That user may not even have a profile. I don't know. There's weird things that might happen there. Static methods can be interesting. Hidden object creation. This is what I call it when inside of a method that you're trying to test, it news up the other thing. That's the kind of a dependency that can be really hard to get rid of. Complex external frameworks. How many of you guys have to work in SharePoint? BizTalk. Fewer than it used to be on that one. Other frameworks where just by the fact that you're there, testing sucks. Right? Complex external frameworks where the designers of the framework and the API that you have to consume to play there didn't ever expect that you would want to do this, and so you end up with this world. Right? ASP.NET MVC came about as one of the forces that led to it was a desire to make sure that your controllers were separated from your view code and your ASP.NET applications so that we can test it. Interestingly enough, I've found some problems in their new web API where I suddenly have a long setup. And I had to be sure to let them know last week when I found this. And of course, if you have code that has no tests at all, the odds are very, very good that it's going to be hard to test. That's a really obvious giveaway. You wouldn't believe how many people have come up to me just in the last week while I've been here and said, "You know, we're thinking about doing some unit testing." Okay, that's good. The point I made to a gentleman last night, I was speaking at a user group meeting, is that if you currently have zero tests and you add one, you're infinitely better than you were before. So these untestable systems are going to be challenging for us. So let me give you an interesting example, a really, really simple one. So if we have this method that we want to test, is file empty string file? Looks pretty straightforward. It's nice and short. Follows that whole rule of methods shouldn't be seven lines or more than seven lines long, if you believe in it. This is an interesting problem for us. Is this a good test for it? Well, that dependency right there forces this little strange bit of setup code. And while it's not really like a whole bunch of lines of setup code, It does have some interesting implications on us. Where is that file being written? Will the build server have permission to do this? Will the test framework have permission to do this? What happens if the write fails? Is this really the right way to test this? Now, we may not have a lot of choices, but this should start to get our attention. That setup is problematic. Or how about this one? Throw if end of world. I'm not sure if everyone anymore has been working in the business long enough to remember this day. The day the world was going to end, remember? And every computer in the world was going to shut down. So if datetime.now is 2000 January 1st, throw a new YK2K bug exception. How would you test that, right? Is this a good way to test it? Does anybody even recognize what I'm doing here? So set system time is going to change the clock on my computer. Okay? And of course, after this test runs, my computer now thinks it's, you know, January 1st, 2000. So there's yet another test of the Y2K bug fix. And hopefully, my Windows 8 machine handles it well. But right, that first line in this test is going to do that. It's going to set the system clock. All right, let's think about that. What permissions are required for that? Does the test have to run elevated? Does it have to be an admin? Maybe we don't want to write our test that way. So you can start to see the kinds of things that get my attention when I look at code and I start to wonder about its testability. And I start to wonder about its dependencies and start to wonder about how it was written, how I'm going to test it, and the implications of that on the design of the system I'm working in. Ultimately, the answer here comes down to various kinds of isolation. And there might even be some of you in the room who are old enough to know what that picture is. Again, sorry, I'm showing my age. I just keep doing this. Isolation of the thing you're testing, whether you're doing integration tests or unit tests or whatever, you want to isolate it from the things that you don't want to impact your tests. It's the scientific method. Right? If we're doing science and the scientific method and studies like that, what do? We remove all the variables. We set them constant. And we only adjust a single variable so that we can test our hypothesis. Unit testing is a whole lot like that. So we need to have ways to control those things, to set those scientific boundaries, those scientific controls on our experiment. So when you cannot isolate because you have some of these things, you have really only two choices in front of you. Right? You're gonna, if you have a testable design, if your design is inherently testable and you need to do isolation, then it's not going to be too bad because you're going to have abstraction layers. You're going to have a thing that Michael Feathers in his book calls seams. You're going to have interfaces. You're going to have dependency inversion, dependency injection. You're going to be able to use stubs, mocks, and overrides. When you have an untestable design, however, you're not going to have these abstraction layers. You're going to have static methods hidden all over the place, gigantic classes, gigantic methods, massive amounts of dependencies, sealed types, and your options are going to be very, very limited. You may end up having to write tests that launch your app and click buttons. And those tests are going to be very flaky. David Starr and I demonstrated some of those yesterday. There's an interesting thing is that when you start to find testable code, you find that it adheres to a set of design principles that are often referred to as the solid principles. Bob Martin first kind of coined this term. He started writing about the solid principles back in 2000. I think he didn't really name it solid until 2003. These five principles, when you find highly testable code, you're going to find these five principles. And when you find these five principles, you find code that you can comfortably say is well-designed from an object-oriented purist perspective. It's going to be well-designed code. Single responsibility says, and you know, sometimes when people talk about this one, they say it should only do one thing and it should do it well. I like this definition better. There should only ever be one reason that you need to change it. That kind of makes it a little bit easier to see. Saying it does one thing, well, you can make that one thing in your head kind of be the group of things that's really three things, right? You can play that kind of a game in your mind and feel good about it. But if you find yourself needing to change it, and there's multiple reasons why you would need to change it, okay, now it's a little more obvious when we have a single responsibility problem, okay? Now, the open-closed principle is kind of a weird one, but basically the idea is that a module, a class, a thing should be open for extension, which means you should be able to derive from it and change its behavior, but closed for modification. You shouldn't be able to mess around with its internals. Liskov substitutability This is another one of those ones. Hopefully you guys have read about some of this stuff. Basically, it says that anything that derives from somebody else should be replaceable. You should be able to use it, and the code that consumes it shouldn't care. I can't tell you how many times I've seen this violated. We all do this. Have you ever done this? You derive your new thing from that other thing, not because it really is one of those, but because he's got a method you want to use. Right? But if it is the case that by taking that one and substituting it for the other one in the caller, it would blow up your app, we have a problem. And if you adhere to Liskov's substitutability principle, then you will never do that. Instead of using inheritance, you'll use a different kind of a relationship in order to pick up that bit of code. You'll use composition. If you're in a language that supports it, you'll use mix-ins. You'll use things like that. The interface segregation principle basically says, and you're starting to see more and more of this in the code that we produce at Microsoft, that more smaller interfaces that clearly express the one thing that it's for is better than one gigantic interface that knows how to do 14 things. It's a continuation of single responsibility, except it now is applying directly to the public interface. Okay? And then finally, the dependency inversion principle. Don't take dependencies on concrete, real things, on what Uncle Bob called concretions. Take dependencies on abstractions. So, I'm gonna put that aside, but I wanted to hit it real quick, because as I said, I found it very interesting over the years to find that when I find testable code, it adheres to these five things. When I find code that I would think of as well-designed, object-oriented code, it adheres to these five things, which starts to help us feel better about why so many people have been saying that code that is extremely testable is better designed. All right, put all the theory behind us now, because I promised you that we were going to spend some time in code messing around with stuff. So if we have this chunk of code, we have this thing, we have this Y2K checker throw if the end of the world is coming, etc. What do we do? Of course, this talk is about Visual Studio 2012 fakes, but before we get there, I have to show you a little bit about what we have to do to code to set it up for good design, because there's different ways that we can use fakes against our system depending on how it's designed. And I'm going to walk from the good way into the ugly bad way. We support them both. The evil way, as I described it in my blog. Fakes, shims are evil, you'll hear me say today a few times. So when we refactor to interfaces, we find those external dependencies, we wrap them with interfaces, and then we create a class that controls and manages that external dependency. It's really easy to do. It's not particularly complicated. We have some tools that help us. And if you're using some of the third-party refactoring tools, it gets even easier and better. That way, then, the class can express its requirements. This is really a nice thing from just a readability perspective. You come across this code later, and you look in its constructor, and here's what I need. I need these to be happy. It's really nice. Otherwise, you don't know what he depends on, right? You might be able to look at the using directives and get a sense of it, or you got to pour through a few hundred lines of code looking for everywhere you say new, or everywhere you call a static method. Or maybe you're lucky and you're using a tool that shows fancy flying arrows. I don't know. Or we can start to use the tools that we have in Visual Studio Ultimate for doing architecture exploration and digging around and but this is not a nice way to do it. You're in the code. You're a coder, right? You want to see it right there. Now, there are some patterns that we use when we use interfaces like this. One of them is called null object. Null object is an implementation of an interface that does nothing. It's kind of nice. The other one is one that I call default implementation, and I do this as an intermediate step while I'm doing the refactoring to interfaces. Basically, it's the implementation of the interface still in the system that does what the old thing did when I used to make the ugly call. And that way, all the code that calls it doesn't have to be refactored yet. I can change him in isolation. And then dependency injection version of control. I'm sure you guys have run across these. A lot of frameworks for it, a lot of capabilities. I've been dabbling quite a bit with Ninject lately. Been coding with MEF for years. I wrote some of the core stuff that sits inside the Unity application block from Patterns and Practices. So this is an area I'm quite familiar with. And what's nice about this is that then you really don't have to think about it very much anymore. Right, you express your dependencies on your constructor or through attributes, and the system just kind of builds itself up. But that's got its own confusion points, too. I'm sure you've run across this, where you're like, how does it do that? All right, you got 37 classes here. None of them appear to talk to each other. And when I push F5, the app works. It's kind of cool. See a question back here. Yes, sir. Yeah, so. All right, so the question was, or the comment was, he's got classes that depend on too many objects. If you can hold for just a second, I have a name for that, and we'll be getting to it in a few slides, okay? Near the end of the talk, I have a name for that kind of a class. We'll see if it sticks as a pattern name. Okay, so I'm going to quickly take us through this, and then the whole rest of the talk is going to be digging into fakes. So let's take a look at some code. So here we have the example from my slide. Throw if the end of the world. So if we wanted to extract interface, if we want to refactor this to interfaces, first let's figure out what do we really need to get rid of? What's the problem here? The problem is actually this block of code right here. That's the problem. Datetime.now. That's the one we want to get rid of. We need to figure out how to make him go away. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a constructor. And I'm going to introduce a new interface here, iCurrentDateTimeProvider. Okay, current time provider. Now, I mentioned earlier the idea of the default object pattern. I'm going to put that here in just a minute. That way, any code that depends on this class can continue to call the default constructor and get the right answer. But we got to fill that in just a minute. So if we need to figure out what iCurrentDateTimeProvider does. So let's go over to that interface and take a look. He returns a date time. He's got a single method. If you think about that idea of the interface, the principle of having more smaller interfaces. Right? This is clearly a small interface. It does one thing and one thing only. So let's stash that away into a field. Okay, and now we can get rid of this datetime.now. Oops. Ah, I didn't put the field in. That's what he's upset about. I'll fix that first. Okay. So now we've made it go away. That method is now easier for us to test because we have this interface. It also now is clearly expressing its dependency on a particular environmental construct. Admittedly, this is a little contrived. I have another example we'll go to in a second that's a little more real world, but sometimes we have to start with the things that are kind of dumb and simple. Now, what we want to do is we want to have an implementation of that interface that can provide our default. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to call the other one with the default date time provider, which doesn't exist yet, but I'm going to create it right here as a private class because I don't want anybody else ever using this. Or else we'll just end up in this exact same problem again. All right, we'll let Visual Studio help us out by implementing that interface. And here is where I will put that return datetime.now. Okay? Now this exists, in an ideal world, I would say that this default implementation resides here only, and it's only useful really during this interim period while I'm starting to establish these patterns. I'm starting to get these things rolling in my system. So at this point, my old app should still run good, and now I have complete isolation of that date time. So we should be able to create a test for it. So what we can do now is we should be able to bring up the end of the world checker. Might be missing a reference. One second. Pick up a reference to the system under test here. There we go. Now we've got our little drop-down thingy. Make up a new one of those. Now, we have a little bit of a problem. We need to give him something. Oops. Because what we want to do is we want to make an implementation of that interface that we control. So we'll call it a stub checker. Now, everybody who's run into this before is already thinking this is getting ugly. You're having to write a lot of code that I really didn't want you to have to write. But trust me, we'll be getting rid of it. So let's use 2002, January 1st, just to confirm. And what we expect is that this guy will not throw. Of course, we're in MS test here, so really the only way to confirm that it will not throw is to just call it. So we'll pass in one of our stub checkers, and we'll call it, and it shouldn't throw. Let's check our test run here. Okay. That is kind of, in a nutshell, what it looks like as we start to introduce this interface extraction. We're going to start pulling these things out of our code and start introducing new ways to deal with it. Let me show you a little more concrete example now. So we've seen the basic one. I'm going to jump over to a project over here. What I've done is this application, I'll run it real quick so you can see what the app does. This application is a UI that sits in front of the US Geological Survey's Earthquake Data Web Service. Okay? Fortunately, the internet is behaving for me, and so it reached out there, made a call, got back a bunch of data, and it shows me all of the earthquakes that have happened recently. And the feature that I wanted to add here is this search down here. Okay, so I created a little bit of UI, and it lets me come in here and say, let me see all of the earthquakes that had a magnitude greater than 5. This is what I want to do. This is the system I want to build. Now let's drop back out again. So I like to use MVVM, the model view model pattern, anyway. But I still, even when I'm using that pattern, I might find myself writing some code that's problematic. And let me show you the kind of code I'm talking about. Let's look at this code right here. So on line 55, you can see I'm making a call out through my service proxy, which wraps up the USGS call. But on line 53, I newed up this USGS call. I created one concretely, newed up a concrete class inside of the method that's doing the work. This is depending instead of on an abstraction, I'm depending on, you know, a concreteism. I'm depending on a concrete thing. This is a problem. We need to introduce an interface here. So it turns out that this proxy class actually already has that concept. It implements iEarthquake service proxy. So I don't have to do the actual extract interface of that concrete class. We already have one of those. But I do need to introduce that interface into my search. And so we're just going to do the exact same thing we did in the other one. We're going to introduce a constructor, and we're going to take that constructor, iEarthquake service proxy, like this. Let him make a field for me. You did make a field for me, right? Good. I guess he put it somewhere not on the screen, okay? And I'm going to do the same thing where I did that default game before. That way the code that calls it continues to work, okay? I would like to get rid of that constructor, let me be completely honest with you, and eventually I will try to get rid of that constructor, but at this point, now what I have is I have a testable version of this. Question way over there. So the question is, he observed that I'm using the constructor to express the dependency by putting it right there on line 17. And the question is, what's the difference between property injection, so that would be me doing properties on this object, versus constructor injection? And there has been a lot of argument in the dependency injection community over the years about this, and I'll give you my 2 cents on it. I believe that if you actually depend on it, it's a requirement, you must have it, it belongs on the constructor. If it's a you can have it, and if you do have it, you might do extra things, then it makes sense to put it as a property. So I like to use them both, but I use them for 2 different reasons. A hard dependency, the object is not valid, it's in an invalid state without it. What I don't like about using property injection in that case is that I actually can new one up. Yes, that's why I said I wanted to get rid of these defaults. But you notice the default now has got a hard dependency, and we're back to that hard dependency problem. So assuming I didn't have this constructor here, and I told you I wanted to get rid of it, right? If I didn't have him, I like this better, because now as a reader of this code, as the consumer of this code, it is very obvious to me what I have to fulfill to use it. The defaults do get you around that, and you may like the defaults. That's fine. If the defaults are a pattern that you like to use, use it. But still make sure that you have the dependency one as well so that you can resolve those and express those differently. Okay, so now we can write a test against this guy. Over here we should be able to create a search view model tests guy. And we should be able to test some stuff. So we'll create up a search view model. And we're going to use the testing constructor. Right, so now I can create one of those. And so I'm going to start to have to play the same kind of game you saw me play just a minute ago. Stub data provider thingy. Right, and he's going to implement iEarthquake proxy something or other. Right? iEarthquake service proxy. And again, I do it as a private class. I do it right here locally, because this is where it has meaning. Right? I'd fill that in. Okay? So in the real world, we can do this in exactly the same way, and it really isn't any harder. All right. So I still haven't shown any fakes yet, but I had to give us a little bit of a foundation so that we could have a conversation about the patterns that I'm going to want to be talking about as we start getting into talking about the two different kinds of fakes, when to use them, where, why, how, and then how we're going to tweak them and make them really do nutty things. Let's jump back over to here for a sec. So there are some good parts, and to be honest, there are some bad parts. I like the fact that the code, after I do this, clearly expresses its requirements. I really do like when I can run across a class and I can look at its constructor and I can see very clearly what it needs, what it wants, what it has to have to be used. That's great. Makes it really easy to start to compose these things together in interesting ways. I was watching a video this morning of a Ruby expert talking about similar kinds of patterns in the Ruby on Rails world. And she was talking about the same thing, that it's really nice when you can know that, because the point she made is other people in your team or in teams around you are going to use your stuff. And it'd be nice if they used it correctly. And so by expressing those dependencies, you can make it really obvious how you're supposed to use it, what is required to fulfill you. It helps to, I like that it gets me this loose coupling, right? And we're now free to replace those external APIs. Perhaps we wanted to replace that datetime.now with something else, because maybe we're in a different environment where datetime.now is not something I can call. Okay, perhaps that example isn't very good, but if you have been experimenting with writing Metro applications, you may have discovered that a lot of the APIs you're used to having in .NET aren't there. You have to use a different implementation of that API, because you're constrained by the sandbox of the Metro application. And so system.io.file.write is not available to you. So if you had that external thing wrapped up and encapsulated, you would have an easier time of it. Of course, I would rather not wrap up the real file API. I'd rather wrap up some logical construct in my code, but the same concept applies. We also get higher cohesion. Cohesion is the idea about do one thing, do it well, and do only one thing. Now, there are some dangers in this, and here's the pattern for you. I call it a dependency addict. All right, David Starr and I have been throwing around names for some of these things we've been discovering. A dependency addict is a class that has too many dependencies. And when you find that, you really should ask yourself if there's maybe something wrong here. And dependency addiction and type explosion are also related. I have certainly found that the .NET development community has a little bit of a resistance to this idea of type explosion. Some of the other programming communities don't. They don't seem to mind it as much. I'm not making a judgment statement there. I'm just making an observation. We seem reluctant to create lots of little classes as .NET developers. Whereas in like in Ruby and others, we seem to find that they're quite comfortable to create hundreds of little objects. So somebody once told me that it's because of IntelliSense. Might be. It can be a little expensive to do this. I mean, I had to do that, right? I had to go and extract out those interfaces and put in the new constructor and define the interface and define the default implementation and put in. I had to do all that. And so if you want to end up doing that a lot, it costs you. That can be kind of frustrating. So there might be reasons that you don't want to do it, but let's at least acknowledge that what we're doing is trading one thing for another, right? We're trading off not necessarily having the cohesion, not having that decoupling in favor of not writing 5 or 10 lines of code. Dependency addiction, I actually have a little example of some code I can show you for this. Where did I put him? Ah, well, lost it. I had a nice little dependency addict that I was going to show you that illustrates exactly what we're talking about here. There he is. So, this class should make it pretty obvious what I was talking about. Here we have a dependency addict. Let's see, he needs a logger and a config and a cache and a service and a repository. He does too many things. Okay? So this is the point you were making, and you know, what do we do when we find this? Well, if you look in the pattern literature, you'll also sometimes find this called a God class. Right? It tries to do everything and be everything to everybody. So and there are interesting patterns for refactoring out one of those. Yes, sir?
So how many things is too many things?
How many things is too many things? I'd say you know it when you see it, and don't trust anybody like me to tell you the answer. Okay? You'll know it because you'll look at it and you'll say, that's too many. Sometimes, because, for example, what if all three of these were kind of in a reasonable, they're all kind of reasonably related? Okay, you might have five things, but they're all kind of related. But this guy's, they're not all related. Like the logger might be somebody everybody wants to pick up, but he's also picking up a service and a repository and a cache. Right? He's in three different worlds here. It would be better if we weren't, maybe. So that's the only guidance I'll give you there, right? And I'd say if you hear anybody else come up on stage and they tell you four, no, don't believe them. The answer's not four. You'll know it when you see it. And trust yourself, right? If you feel like it's too painful to bring these things up and you really are doing too much, then you'll know. Okay. Yes? Most orchestration kinds of classes will need all of these external dependencies. Is that your point? Yes, but also let's recognize that there are patterns we can use in patterns and refactorings that we can use to make those orchestration classes a little bit better. Okay? They can be challenging patterns to use, and I'm referring to the evil visitor pattern. Okay? But it can be used to make some of those go away. Orchestration classes in particular can be good candidates for the visitor pattern, even though I'm famous for hating the visitor pattern. And when I find it, I almost always try to get it to go away. I've rarely found a good one, but they do exist, I've been told. Okay. So, all right, so let's talk about now the actual act of unit testing once we've done this. Now we're going to start getting into the world of stubs and mocks. A little bit about the difference between them. When I use the words, I'm going to be very explicit. A stub implements an interface and is a Liskov substitutably type replaceable implementation of that interface. In other words, it implements that interface and I can use it. That's all. It's not about verify or verification or any of those kinds of things, behavioral verification. A mock, on the other hand, is a stub that has state and behavioral verification checking. So when I use those words, be very clear, I'm being explicit. We do in the community very commonly intermingle those terms and we'll say mock when we mean stub. Okay, that's fine. I'm not being critical of that. I do it as well. But for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to be explicit. In Visual Studio 2012, we have introduced, as part of the fakes feature set, a stubs system that generates these stubs for us. We generate them at compile time, which means they run lightning fast. We will automatically regenerate them when the thing that is being stubbed changes, so you don't even have to worry about it. It just goes away. We use plain Jane, C-sharp, and VB language features when you interact with them. You don't have any special APIs to learn. Okay? And they are type-wise, and I say ISA, compatible with the interface that you create, which means if we look at the code for them, we'll see they do implement that interface. So let's go back to the project we were playing in just a second ago. This one here. So I had this stub that I created myself right here in my test code. And that's a little frustrating. I didn't really want to do that. And when we use the Visual Studio Stubs feature, we don't have to. So I'm going to delete it and show you how we create one. So in our test project over here in the Solution Explorer, we can see that this test project takes a reference, I'll zoom in here so you can see it, takes a reference on the WPF client project. I forgot. I had to reboot when I connected to this monitor, so I lost my zoom it. There we go. So we can see that we have a reference on the WPF client project. Now, in order to create the fakes for this project, I simply right-click on it and choose Add a Fakes Assembly. And we will, behind the scenes, automatically parse that thing, inspect that thing, reflect over it, do everything we need to do, and then we will generate a new assembly. We'll take a reference to that new assembly, we'll add some stuff to your project file, and we'll regenerate it every time it needs to be regenerated. You do not check the generated assembly into source code. We regenerate it when it's needed. Now, of course, if you're doing fakes against a third-party library, it's never going to change, so it really only ever happens once. And I have had people say that they think in that case it's probably a good idea to check in the assembly. You don't really have to. You can, but you don't really have to. I would say that if you are doing a fake assembly against something in your solution, like we're doing here, I would really strongly recommend you don't check it in, because they really don't take that long to generate at build time. And they're only going to regenerate when you change the target. So we've generated that assembly already. And you can see Visual Studio went ahead and added the reference to it for us, so we don't even have to mess around. Now, what happens behind the scenes here is we run through the assembly, picking up all of the interfaces and all of the classes, and we generate new classes that derive from them. And on each one of those newly generated classes is a field that is a delegate type. And you can assign to that delegate your own implementation of the method. Now, when we're talking about a class in the system under test, of course, the stub can only override those things that are virtual in that class. So if it's an abstract class, it'll give you the abstract methods if it's and the virtuals. But you can only get those things that are available from an overriding perspective. When it's an interface, we get a class that implements the entirety of that interface. So let's take a look at this one here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you where it lives, okay? If we look in the namespace WPF client, which is the project we're testing here, we have now got a new sub-namespace called fakes. So all of the fakes for the WPF client type are going to live in a sub-namespace called .fakes. And that pattern persists everywhere. So if we generate fakes against system, it's going to be system.fakes. System.io.fakes. They're always going to be one down, which makes them easy to find. And what we want is stub. I need to regenerate there. I added that. Where's my interface? Okay. I just remembered it's actually in the other one. Because what we really wanted is the iEarthquake service. So we went stub, iEarthquake service proxy. Okay, that's the type we generate. We prefix stub at the beginning. I've received a lot of criticism over this decision. I understand. It's the way it is. We can consider it later. It's what we do. So let's not attack that right now. But there it is. And you can see it lives in webservice.proxy.fakes. Easy to find. Okay. So we're going to new one of these up. There we go. And I said that on that newly generated stub are fields that are of type delegate that we can assign things to. Let me put my cursor on that guy and hit F12, and we'll go in and take a look at what Visual Studio thinks he's actually defined as. Okay, make these guys go away in full screen mode. There we go. So it has a default constructor, of course, and it has this ugly, long, nasty field delegate thing here. And if we go way out to the end, sets the stub of iEarthquakeServiceProxy.getDataAsync. And the reason the type definition for this field is so long is because of the type definition of the method on the interface. Right? Ultimately, it's a func of whatever he returns. So let's go take a look at how I will use this now. So stub dot, and it is getDataAsync. Right? You can see it's a field. Now, I like to use lambda expressions for this. I find that it lets me keep the code for the method that we're overriding right here in the tests, and I like that. But you don't have to. It's just a delegate. Any delegate will be valid for doing this. So I'm going to do it with a lambda. If we go and take a look at the signature of that getDataAsync, of the real getDataAsync, over here, and take a look at that guy. So it's a task of ienumerable of earthquake event. And it's a task because I'm using the task programming library. It's an ienumerable because it's a collection of things. And earthquake event is the value object that's going to be coming back with it that wraps up the JSON return that we got from the USGS. So let's take a look then what I want to do. So he doesn't take any parameters and he returns stuff. So a non-parameter lambda looks like this. All right. Well, he's not returning anything, so Visual Studio is unhappy with me and not letting me compile quite yet. So what do we need to do? We need to build up an enumerable of earthquake event. Well, there's a couple ways we can do that. The easiest way, believe it or not, is for us to make an array. So let's do this. Let's do a new earthquake event array, and I'm going to populate it. This is taking advantage of kind of that instant array initialization trick with two values. I'll put a new earthquake event in there, and I'll put another new earthquake event in there. I need to use a comma. Then we'll close that curly, which closes the array. Now, here we are, we have this array, so we'll say this is called test data. Okay, so we have our test data. Well, it turns out we can just return that test data dot as enumerable. Okay? That didn't work. You can see Visual Studio is still not happy with me. I'm sorry? The second earthquake event? Yeah, that's not really the problem, though. But good catch. You see, he's really not happy with my return line. And he's not happy with my return line because I need to return a task of that. I'm using the task programming library. So, of course, when you start to use the task programming library, you can find yourself doing interesting things like this. Task of ienumerable of earthquake data event dot run, right? And what are you going to do when you run them? I don't want to create a whole background thread for this. Really, this is a test object, so we're not going to. What we're going to do is we're going to say task dot from result of ienumerable of earthquake data. And what this really does is this basically fakes out the idea of a background thread, creates a thing that looks like it would have been on a background thread but isn't. Okay? Now I got no red squiggly lines, I'm happy. So the most complicated part here was actually the fact that I was dealing with an async task bit of code, but that little trick of from result is a very useful one that you're going to find yourself using when you're testing with the task stuff. So now we have a stub. We can use it. That instant initialization thing is kind of useful, so I want to show you something. I'm going to take the test data, pull it out of my test, put it up here. Okay. I'm going to pull it up here because I might end up using this test data for a whole bunch of different tests. That's good. So now we don't have to do that down there anymore. And the other thing I can do is I can use instant initialization, that constructor initialization, right on the stub itself. Okay, and now I get rid of this, And now we have it all in one place. So now we have a stub. The stub provides an override for get data async. It returns that fake data. It's now easy for us to use. So now we can build up a system, search view model, and we'll use the constructor that we created a little bit, pass in the stub, and now we can make calls on that system. Do search. Okay? And we can assert on the results, we can set its properties, we can do all the other things that we would do with our view model. Okay? Now, that stub was generated at compile time. And stub doesn't use any crazy profilers or anything like that. It's a statically compiled thing. And because it is, and because we're using language constructs and compilation to achieve all of this, stubs are amazingly fast. There's no reflection emit going on. There's no magic stuff. And so if we go and take a look at how long this test took to run, and we'll go up here and find our test, test some stuff. There it is. 5 milliseconds is all that test took to run. Right? Speedy Gonzales, good stuff. We like our tests to run fast. This is good. So stubs are very easy to use, and you can use them against anywhere you have interfaces and classes that have virtual methods. So, and that includes crazy places like system. So if we take a look here in our test project, we have our system reference. And you might not realize this, but the system reference is actually two. Okay, it is the it is MS Corelib and it is system.dll. So you're going to notice when I generate the fakes for this, I'm going to get two different fakes assemblies generated and two different references in my references list. And there are going to be a whole lot of stubs in there because, as you can imagine, there are a whole lot of interfaces in there. There we go. There came MS Corelib and there's system fakes. And they do have version numbers on them, and we do that in order to work around some of the issues with building on build servers and things like that. So when they're strongly signed and all that, we magically generate a name that corresponds. Okay. Jump back over to our materials. So that was stubs in a nutshell, going pretty fast because I still want to get to the cool stuff. They're concrete derivatives of interfaces and non-sealed classes. They're generated at compile time. They run very fast. They use language, standard language primitives to work with. No special API. Use your own delegates. You can put them in the test class. You can use delegate, or you can use lambda expressions. And if you want, you can use that constructor initialization trick to put it all in one place with a single new line, which makes it easy to read. Now, what about when you can't refactor? Oh, no. I love that puppy. If your class derives from an untestable concrete type that has a complex internal setup. SharePoint, for all of you who are writing web parts, right? You derive from SP part. Good luck there. Interestingly enough, the web API one has a challenge here. If you are doing post and if you want your post to follow the REST convention of returning a created status code with a location in your response message. If you're doing web APIs, you know what I'm talking about, and trust me, that creates a problem because some of that stuff is all magically hidden up inside of web API. All the rest of them work great, it's just that one. Or you have complex graphs of objects that have to be set up properly before you can create them. Right? These are situations where you can't refactor them at all. You don't have a choice. There's nothing you can do about it. It's the world you live in. Or you have lots of legacy code and you don't have any time. That's a legitimate one. You don't want to bother with going through and doing this interface extraction stuff. You just need to keep moving. You got deadlines to meet, bosses to appease. Or you might even have organizational design prohibitions, right? This is your organization, your environment actually says, no, we don't do interfaces. Okay. Still want to test it. I want to talk briefly about a thing I call the catch-22 of refactoring. So, you know, if you've been coming to these talks by guys like me and the Agilista, Robin Sandals guys, you know, you go up and ask them the question after the talk and you say, So, you know, what do I do if my class isn't testable? He's given a TDD talk. And he says, well, refactor it. Make it testable. Okay. I read Martin's book. He says it's a disciplined technique for restructuring, altering its internal structure without changing its external behavior. Doesn't that mean I have to have tests first? I just told you I can't. So we have a catch-22. I can't test it, but I have to test it to refactor it, and you told me I have to refactor it. It sounds like the Osarian all over again. So the code doesn't have unit tests. How do we know if we change the external behavior? Now we're going to start getting into shims. I said isolating your code from external dependencies the brute force way. All right, let's get in there and do some ugly. So I'm going to show you a little block of code here. If you're with me yesterday, you saw some of it, but I'm gonna do a bunch more. So, but this one gets us started quickly. if we take a look at this chunk of code right here, right? So the problem is line 44. He news up a dispatch timer, and the reason he news up a dispatch timer is because he's gonna sit and tick along 1 second at a time. And every time through that loop, he's gonna update a message on the screen. That's line 48. And after 30 times through the loop, he's gonna refresh the call to the web service. So if I run the app, you can actually see this happen. I'm not gonna make you wait 30 seconds, but if you look down at the bottom left, you'll see he's counting down. So every 30 seconds, he's gonna update the map. He's gonna update the list view. So I don't have to, that's why there's no refresh button on the screen. He'll do it automatically. Hopefully it is not so busy in earthquake world that 30 seconds is too long to wait. I have been surprised, though, that all day I've been running this and the list is constantly changing. I mean, they're just rolling in. All kinds of stuff going on in California and Alaska recently. Okay. So how do we deal with that? We've got to make that dispatch timer go away because we want to test something about it. Let's pick something that we want to test. Let's go create a new test and actually build it up from scratch, and I'll show you how we can use shims to resolve the problem. So I'm going to go into this class. We're going to go right down to the bottom. I'm going to hide everything else, and we'll make a new test here. Now, in this example, I'm using the XUnit.net testing framework instead of MS Test. Nice thing about Visual Studio 2012, you can use whatever test framework you want. So I'm going to go ahead and use XUnit. In XUnit, a test is called a fact. We don't really care. It's just a test method. And this will be our demo test. So we'll just call it that for a second. So we want to view up one of these, or new up one of these view models. So we'll new up the main page view model. All right, well, it turns out this view model's already had its interface extraction done on it, so we know that we're going to have to give it a stub real quick of the Earthquake service proxy. So we'll give him one of those real quick, just to make him happy, because he expressed that on his constructor. Okay. Okay. So we have our view model. Now, let's suppose that what we want to check here is that the refresh timer, after 30 seconds have gone by, is going to call that update method again. We've got to get that refresh timer out of the way, or else we're going to write a test that waits for 30 seconds. Right? That might be our first way of doing it. You know, we'll just go ahead and say sleep for 30 seconds. That's not going to be a fast-running test suite. So instead, we're going to make the dispatch timer go away. So just like we created these stub types in that fakes namespace, we also create shim types in that fakes namespace. And so we have now a shim type that I've generated from the dispatch timer. So I went here, I hit F12, I went to the top, and I saw that dispatch timer is defined in windowsbase.dll. Okay? Well, in my test project, I went to the references, I found windowsbase, I right-clicked on it, I said add fakes assembly, and I got this guy right here. So now I've got all my shims and stubs. Don't have to think about that anymore. And again, that one doesn't change ever, so it's not like you're going to have to worry about that very much. So now I can say shim dispatch timer. Okay. Maybe I'm just not spelling it right. Is it? It is. My goodness. Thank you. Good catch. Now, that dispatch timer got newed up inside that method, so I can't substitute it. I can't replace it. I have to figure out a way to say, replace all of them that get newed up whenever, anytime. Doesn't matter. So I'm going to say all instances. And now we're going to go and find that tick event handler. So remember the code over there. Here, let me split the window so you can see this side by side. The code we have over there is assigning this Lambda delegate to the tick, and we want to catch that. We want to steal that method. And what we're going to do is we're going to grab that method body and we're going to hold on to it. And we're going to call it 30 times. Works. That's just like calling 30 seconds, right? Except it doesn't take that long. So we'll go ahead and grab it, right? So we know that the tick event handler on the dispatcher timer object takes some parameters. Turns out that what it takes is it's got that object sender event args kind of a thing going on there, okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to collect the parameters into our lambda expression, instance handler, and we're going to create a lambda for it to collect up that value. Because what we really want to do eventually, I'm just going to show you what I really want to do, if I had collected the tick handler, we'll call it tick, right? So suppose I've collected up this tick at some point. Later on, what I want to do is I want to say this, for int I equals 0, I is less than 30, so in other words, we're going to loop 30 times, call tick. That's what we really want to do. That's how we're going to simulate the 30-second run here. So I just need to now collect that. So we'll say tick equals handler. Okay? Turns out I don't need that, and I also don't need this anymore. Collect it all up into one line. Okay, this really can't be a tick, right? It has to be, what is it? What is he going to be? Gotta go look and see. Forgot his type. Just a plain old Jane, plain Jane event handler. Good stuff. Okay. It appears this class actually wants something else. Okay, so this is going to get us the event handler. We'll now have it. We also really don't want him to start up that timer, right? We don't really need him to do that part. So let's take over that one too, just to make sure he doesn't. So we're going to again go to the all instances one start, and we're just going to say don't. So we replaced it with a no op. You can imagine that what's really happening here, and I'll explain to you a bit about how this works in the internals. There is a profiler. And we're actually leveraging the same profiler that sits underneath IntelliTrace. And that profiler, the .NET framework is calling to every time as the code is running, it's doing stuff. He calls out to the profiler and says, hey, we're about to call a method. Do you want to play? And when the profiler is involved here, what he does is he records the time. And then when the method ends, he records the time again. And you can use this to find how your application is performing. This is great. What IntelliTrace is doing is collecting up variables and all kinds of useful stuff for you so you can debug after, you know, an app that's been in production. Well, what we're doing is we're putting in a go-to. Okay? So we put in a go-to so the old code doesn't happen at all. Now, there is actually a way to call the old code, and we'll get to that in a minute. But we're just going to take that over. Say, no, we don't really want you to do anything, thank you. Now, I have a couple problems I need to deal with here. First of all, tick is an event handler. Therefore, what he wants is a sender and some args. Well, we don't really care if he does anything. So we're just going to give him nothing. And start, apparently, is not quite happy either. Thank you. You know the best part about coding on stage with 600 of your friends is they act like the compiler. It's wonderful. I've said for years that, you know, so when I'm pair programming with somebody, I'm sitting typing away, and he's like, hold on, dude, you missed an angle bracket there. I'm like, the compiler will catch it. It's cool, man. Just keep going. On stage, I've always got all this wonderful group of helpers who are going to help me solve the problem. Apparently, I still didn't get it right, though. Let's see. What do you want? Does not take zero arguments. Oh, did the real one not take zero arguments? Sure looked like it did. No, it's this one here. Let's take a look. So, nice thing about it is, of course, since we've pre-compiled this, all of your normal Visual Studio F12 stuff is available to you. In fact, the assembly is even available to you in the object browser. And in just a minute, I'm going to show you how to even read its code. All right, so there it is. It's an action, start, you set it. It wants an action, dispatch timer. Ah! Has anybody ever played around with like IL-Spy or Reflector or IL-DASM and all these other things, and you rip the code apart? Cool. Okay, so if you've done any IL coding at all, you know that there's every single instance method on a class actually takes what we call the zeroth argument. And it's the one that in your code you can refer to with the keyword this. This is an instance method. I need to provide a place for it. There it is. Now, sometimes I'll do this. You guys know that you can take a regular old Visual Studio keyword that you're not allowed to use for a variable and actually use it for a variable? It's kind of neat. So, like, I can create a variable called if I put the at in front of it. It's kind of a cool trick. I always recommend people don't ever do that. That is such a terrible idea. Oh, God, a variable called if, really? So now I'm going to say if equals false. Or how about a variable called false that is equal to true? No. This is one case, the case I'm about to show you, where I actually do it. And I do it to remind myself what that variable is. That variable is the this pointer. Because inside that lambda expression, it means exactly the same thing as it would mean if you were writing the code, this dot. But I can't use the real this because it's a variable, so I have to use the at this. So when you run across this in any of my samples, don't be too surprised what you're seeing. I taught you the trick now. Okay. Use of unassigned local variable equals, really? It isn't unassigned. There, now it's not unassigned. Now, the method we were looking at over here on the right-hand side is the one called startTimer. So we know that startTimer is going to new up the dispatch timer. We know that he's going to call tick, and we know that he's going to call start. We've made start go away. We've taken over the tick and collected out the lambda that he provided, and we're going to call it 30 times. Cool. Now, what I'm going to prove to you here is I'm going to put a breakpoint right there on his code for the tick. Okay, and I'm going to put a breakpoint right here on my code for the tick, and I'm going to debug this test. I'll go over here to the test explorer, find that guy in my list. There he is, and we will, there we go, he ran it for me. It failed. Let's figure out why. Okay, what happened here? We got an invalid operation exception from shims. Was anybody paying attention closely when I said for how long these overrides exist when we're using shims? Forever. That's a problem. Within this app domain, those overrides of those methods, those injected go-to statements are here forever. Okay, that's a problem. We can't do this. And in fact, if we take a look at what this exception is telling us, he's saying, yeah, you're going to have a problem because you're going to take it over forever. We actually won't let you do that. And this is just a safety mechanism that we baked in to protect you. There really is no good reason why you would ever want to get around this. And you can see what he says right here. He even gives you the snippet of code that you're supposed to use. Shims must be specified within a context. It provides a scoping boundary for when we will remove the go-to statement. That's it. So we are required to wrap this thing up. And again, this is one of those things I have certainly received some criticisms on, but there's really only a couple of ways to do this. And one of them would be for me to put an attribute on there, but that would also require me to get every test framework who plays to implement support for that special attribute. I didn't feel like I wanted to do that. We just done all this wonderful work to get all the third-party test frameworks into Visual Studio. I don't want to now go tell them they also have to change their test framework. So wrap it up in a context. It's only one line of code. It's not that hard to do. So we're going to now put that breakpoint back on. We've got it. Good. We're going to go back over to the test explorer. We're going to debug that test, and we're going to watch and see, not analyze code coverage. We're going to debug that test, and we're going to watch where the breakpoint hits. Which one's it going to be? There we go. So we can see then that the lambda expression that the user provided in his code is not happening. But we did get that lambda expression because it's actually an object in .NET. So we now have it. So we'll go ahead and step through. Look, there it is. Okay. Good stuff. Now, what's interesting about that then is how many times it's going to get called. So I'm going to put a breakpoint right here. Let it run to that point. And I'm just going to keep hitting F10. See how it's bouncing left and right? So we're going through the loop on the left side, and every time through the loop, I'm calling that guy's code over there, even though that code's hidden away inside of a local lambda expression inside of his code. So I did two things here. I took over that dispatch timer, and I got a hold of a private little block of code that was expressed only as a lambda expression in the code. We can use this all over the darn place, and you can take over almost anything in .NET. And I say almost anything because there are a few things that we really don't like you to take over, and that your favorite test framework will not like you to take over. I don't know if you realize this, but unit test frameworks use app domains to load up your stuff and keep them in isolation. Well, what would happen if I took over app domain? Right? If I took over the app domain, I might actually be able to completely, fully crash my test framework. There's even things you can imagine wanting to take over an MS Core lib that will destabilize and crash the CLR runtime. So those things we actually exclude when you try to shim the system assembly, the system reference. All right? But we'll talk about that in a minute, because what happens if I missed one and you want it anyway? We're not done. Still got stuff to show you, so don't go anywhere. Okay. So we can intercept any .NET method there is. It's like a thing that they call in some other languages monkey patching. Okay? Where you basically stick in that go-to. In JavaScript and in Ruby, they call it this. So you can use it anytime you have external components that cannot be refactored. You can use it with things like SharePoint, ASP.NET, Office apps, all those other kinds of weird things. You can do it when you have to override a non-virtual method that you can't pick up with a stub, or if you have legacy code with untestable designs. Great approach. Okay. Back to that catch-22 thing again. Here's my recommendation to everybody. Use the shims to get out of the catch-22. So the Agilista TDD Robin Sandals guy says, refactor your code. You say, I can't because I can't write tests for it. Yes, you can. Write tests using shims. Now, refactor your code. Because we know those object-oriented principles that we talked about at the beginning are important. We know they do lead us to better designs and better code. So we should continue to go there even though we now have a way to test it. And this is my recommendation. Use the shims to get out of the catch-22. There are going to be situations like the ones I talk about in the top where you're going to have to keep the shims for forever or for a long period of time. But when it is your code on both sides of that and you're using a shim to get out of the catch-22, get rid of it. All right. I'm going to show you a whole bunch of tips and tricks here. Let's take a look at some of this stuff. I talked about there's things that you can't use. I've already shown you the closures one. And we're going to start to play around in here a little bit. And then I've got a fun example to show you at the end. So please don't go anywhere. I'm going to do something that you might not have thought of me ever doing. No, don't do that to me yet. Come on. My clock says I still have time. All right. So show you a couple of tricks real quick. If we wanted to get system, thank you. If we wanted to get the system stuff that we couldn't get before, how do we do it? Well, if you look inside of your Visual Studio project, there's a directory that we created called fakes. And in there are these fakes files. And if we open up one of those, we're going to see that what we have is an XML file that we can put stuff in. This configures how we generate that assembly. And basically what we have when you're doing system is we have a whitelist. If it's not on the list of things that Peter said are good, you don't get it. But what you can do here is I can go into shims, the shims generation section. Come on, you. Shim generation. And I can add new types. You're adding to my whitelist by doing this. The reason I make you do this is because I want you to be very crystal clear that you made the decision to shim something that's going to break your test framework, not me. But if you need to do it, you need to do it, okay? Let's just be completely honest here. So we gave you that freedom. You also can clear the list. So if you find that you're generating shims against an assembly that's really, really, really big and it's got all these types in it and you only really need two stubs, Fine, fix it. You go into here, add a stubs generation section, clear the list. Now there's nothing. Add the one type you want the stubs for, and you'll only get that one. So now you can really shrink that compilation phase down too. Shrink the size of that assembly down. You've got full control here. Okay. Now one of the things that people love to ask me is, so where's the code for that? And you know, I'm sharing with you a neat little secret here. If you go down into your OBJ directory and you turn on the All Files button, here's the secret trick. There's a directory called fakes. And for every fakes reference you have, if you kind of look at the words in the name, you can figure out what the subdirectory is called. So we're going to go look in WC, that's web client. Nope, not going to look there. We're going to go look in M, that's MS Core Lib. And we're going to go look at F.cs. Here it is. This is the code for your shims and stubs against MS Core Lib. So if you wonder what's happening on the inside, if you want to see what the code looks like, if you really want to get in here, you want to get down into the dirties, it's here for you. Okay? Now, this is occasionally useful because you might find yourself interested in doing something really weird, like maybe recording out the variables that were passed into the stub. Behavioral verification type tricks, okay? Believe it or not, you can do that. And you can do that because every stub that we have on the stubs constructor allows you to specify an instance observer. An instance observer is a callback that the stub will make onto your code that gives you all of the information about the incoming call on that stub. So now you can do behavioral verification stuff without closures if you don't want to. I was using closures before when I collected that handle into a variable on the outside. All right, I have one more thing to show you. The red light's on. It's getting mad at me, but trust me, this is pretty neat. This is a better than throw end of the world. This is my project that's called Evil Stuff. Okay, here is Evil Stuff. Suppose you had this one. Would you run this test? I will. Let's see. Let's see what my test looks like. So, clearly, if I ran this test, right, oops. This test is going to delete my documents directory. We're not going to run that test. Nope. But look at the next one. I take over directory.delete. All right, here we go. This is the moment of truth. Am I going to erase my documents directory and lose all my presentations for the week or not? Let her rip. Come on. What did it do? Does it say anything? Nice try, but you did not delete users Peter PR documents. Took it over. You can take over anything. You know, that demo's always fun to do, but at the same time, it always makes you a little bit nervous. So think about these solid principles. And hey, I have a quick question before you go. We've been having an interesting problem here so far at TechEd, and I just have one quick request for all of you. We've not really been getting a lot of evals for our talks. Can you guys do me a favor, and while you're heading to your next session, pull out your phone, grab your laptop, whatever, and please submit an eval for the talk. It has been fun showing you guys this stuff. I hope you have a great time. And contact me if you have any questions at all.